what occurs to me and has occurred to other people is that two of those three categories, well, all three of those categoricals I mentioned, the species is a categorical, is an absolute, the individual is an absolute, the tree is the image of life on Earth. Those things are challenged, and those things are going to be, we now recognize they are somewhat blurry, they're going to become more blurry. So the very concept of a species, I mean, we're fighting to preserve biological diversity on this planet. And we're trying to do it species by species, habitat by habitat, ecosystem by ecosystem. But now we're also capable of blurring lines between species. I'm concerned with where that's going to go 100 years from now. Are we even able, going to be able to talk about the species? The blue whale is a species.
That's David Quammen, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. It's great to be back. It's been a couple of weeks, and I hope you are all well. It's been a busy few weeks and will continue to be so for the next couple of months. And hopefully I'll have some announcements as to why, but for the time being, we are going to go to an episode every 3-week schedule. So that's at least for the next couple of months until the end of November, early December, and then we'll go back to our regular frequency. And that is at least one episode every 3 weeks. Hopefully there'll be more, but we'll see just how that goes. We have an absolutely fascinating episode for you today, and one that kind of blew my mind. But before we dive in, let's take care of some business. This episode, first of all, is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. I use Audible regularly. I'm currently listening to Nassim Taleb's Skin in the Game. And the way Audible works is that each month you get a credit for a new audiobook. The credits accumulate and you get to keep your audiobooks no matter what. They have over 180,000 titles. And for my listeners, you get a free 30-day trial. And that includes a free audiobook, which is yours to keep. If you're based in the US, go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk. If you are in the UK, click on the link in the post accompanying this episode. And secondly, if you've recently made a big decision, a big life-changing decision, I'd love to hear from you. I'm collecting a bit of survey information. It takes you about 2 to 3 minutes. There's a link in the show notes for that as well. So with all of that out of the way, let's get into it. As I said just a moment ago, this conversation kind of blew my mind, actually really blew my mind. My guest is science, nature, and travel writer David Quammen. His books have included The Song of the Dodo, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, which describes Charles Darwin's role and attitude towards his theory of natural selection. And It's a Reluctant Attitude, as the title goes. Spillover, which describes emerging diseases and informed shorter work, Ebola and the Chimp and the River. He has written hundreds of shorter pieces in The National Geographic, The New York Times, Rolling Stones, The Atlantic, and many others. But the bulk of this episode is about David's latest book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, which explores some of the drastic revisions in the understanding of life's history on Earth. And that's all forced by recent discoveries of genome sequencing and the story of a scientist called Carl Woese. You may have already been introduced to a concept called horizontal gene transfer. And David has this incredible knack in his writing and in his speaking for making science understandable and pleasurable to absorb. And we get into all of that in this discussion. We also talk about pandemics and the people behind science as well. To quote David, science itself, however precise and objective, is a human activity. David joined me from his home in Bozeman, Montana, in the United States. You will enjoy this, I'm sure. So let's dive in. Here's David Quammen. David, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. Looking forward to this conversation quite a lot. So welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much, Ben. Good to be with you. I look forward to the talk too.
So before we get into the tangled tree and horizontal gene transfer and loads of concepts that I don't really know a huge amount about professionally, but are fascinating to me, I thought it would be great to get a little bit of your background. You've been a science writer for a long time. You've traveled to a variety of places. You've written a number of wonderful books. If you could give us a little bit of an overview of, you know, of who you are and how you got to be doing the types of things you've been doing, that'd
sure.
be great.
Yeah. Well, the thumbnail version is that I started out as a fiction writer, published my first book back in 1970 when I was 22, and it was a novel, and my next few books were novels or a collection of short fiction. And then I drifted into nonfiction during the 1970s, ended up really paying my dues as a writer, not before the first book, but between the first book and the second book. And during that time, I was doing what young, starving, aspiring writers do, tending bar, waiting tables, working as a fishing guide, and discovering nonfiction as a reader, and discovering that nonfiction can be artful and imaginative. And I don't mean creating pseudo facts, but imaginative in terms of the shaping, the way a mosaic is built using facts. And so I turned into a magazine writer specializing in natural history, evolutionary biology, ecology, conservation, and then eventually not just writing magazine pieces about that, but writing books about it, of which the first was The Song of the Dodo in 1996. Mm-hmm. It's a long book about evolution and extinction.
Did you always have a passion for ecology and biology and conservation and those themes?
You know, I always had a passion for the natural world. I wouldn't use those more scientific terms because I really didn't know what science was when I was a kid. But from the age of about 11, at the latest, I was interested in the natural world and I was interested in writing. So it was always those two tracks. And then as it happened, I had some great teachers. I had a lot of wonderful teachers, but I had three great teachers, and they were all English teachers during high school and then one mentor when I was in college. And I think that if those first two great teachers had been biology teachers, I might have ended up a biologist. But instead, I ended up an aspiring writer and with an interest in the novel. And then, as I said, during the 70s, I've sort of circled back around and I connected those two interests, my interest in the natural world and my interest in writing. And at that point, ecology and evolutionary biology and conservation became sort of a journalistic beat for me. Mm-hmm. And most of my education in those realms has been self-education, on-the-job training.
Hmm. Isn't that a wonderful and a powerful lesson in how great your teachers are in our lives?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it is. And that's true, certainly, in my case. I mentioned I had these three great teachers. Two of them were Jesuits, one Jesuit seminarian and one Jesuit priest. I went to a Jesuit high school in Cincinnati and came across these two fellows. And then when I was in college at Yale University, I came under the wing of a wonderful writer and teacher named Robert Penn Warren, multiple Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry and for his novel All the King's Men. And he became my mentor in the fullest sense and helped me become a writer.
That's a wonderful background, and it covers many, many paths. And I think the most interesting people in the world have non-linear backgrounds as well. So things, things jump around. And I think we need more polymaths in this world. So people that you know, like you can, you have an expertise in science and the natural worlds that you've picked up along the way, but you also have this craft of writing. And I remember when I was thinking about majors in university and maybe communication would be one. And I remember speaking to a communications prof and he said, well, what are you going to communicate about though? So That was a good point.
Yes, and I absolutely agree with you that we need polymaths. It's great to aspire to being one. I think that with me, I mentioned Robert Penn Warren, this third grade teacher, mentor, and one of the things that he showed me, he never taught me this in terms of explicitly saying it to me, but he showed me that a writer doesn't have to be just one kind of writer. As I mentioned, he won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction. He won, I think, two Pulitzers for poetry. And yet he also wrote social commentary. He wrote social history. So with his example, I could see that you don't have to be just one kind of writer.
That's very true. Very true. Okay, that really useful stuff. And I think we'll get back to some of this because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the individuals that you discuss in your latest book, The Tangled Tree, and about science and the human side of science. And I love this quote that you have that science is a fundamentally human activity, it's very, very true. And or maybe we can talk a little bit about that now.
Absolutely.
That, you know, I've always wondered about science. In one of the things I've always wondered about science is where does the hypothesis come from? And it you know, it comes from I suppose different places, but it's shaped by the lives and the environments that scientists would have.
That's right, absolutely. And it's not just hypothesis testing, the classic Popperian model of science. Sometimes it's getting your feet dirty, field work, gathering information before you have a hypothesis, although it's easier to be economical about what data you gather if you do have a hypothesis. But for instance, when Charles Darwin went on the voyage of the Beagle and spent 4 years, 9 months, and 5 days with this crew of British seamen circling the globe, he went off on that journey without a hypothesis. He was very interested in geology in particular, in beetles, and in natural history generally, including biology. And his eyes were wide, his mind was open, he was profoundly curious, but he didn't go off saying, well, I'm going to discover the theory of evolution, or I think that evolution occurred, and I'm going to try and find out just how and assemble data to support that idea. He didn't. That happened while he was out there. It happened very slowly, and it was sort of an inchoate idea that crept up on him. So it's absolutely true. Science is a human process, like grandmaster chess and ballet, and Major League Baseball. And that means it involves personalities and quirks and accident and competition, as well as cooperation and ambition and sometimes grudges. and that's what makes it fascinating. That's what makes it such a wonderful realm for narrative and not just for explanation.
Yes, yes. I want to get into some of that. But before we do, I also want to talk about your work on pandemics. And you wrote a book on Ebola. You also talk about this concept of in one of your other books, spillover, and it's related to the work that you do. I mean, I see there's a lot of continuity in the Tangled Tree and your previous work. I feel the dots do join up, you describe it as a bit of a risk in terms of the type of book that you've written. But could we just talk a little bit about some of your prior work around Ebola and spillover? I think that would be very interesting.
I got interested in Ebola back in the late 90s sometime. And then I was sent off. I agreed to do a three-part assignment for National Geographic magazine that involved walking across the Congo Basin with an explorer scientist, a wonderful fellow, an American named Mike Fay. And a photographer and I spent weeks accompanying him on fragments of his his expedition, which went on for 456 days. And in the course of that, one of the fragments that I walked with him was about a 10-day section in northeastern Gabon, during which we walked through – this was all walking through trackless forest, walking off trail, bushwhacking, following a compass line that he had plotted. This was a biological survey expedition to see what was there in these last remaining intact forests of the Congo Basin. Hmm. And so we followed his compass line, and in this particular stretch, it took us through a forest called the Minkebi Forest in northeastern Gabon, which was Ebola habitat. Mm-hmm. There had been a famous Ebola outbreak back in 1994 in this area. Dozens of local people had died, and I knew about that, and I had read about it, and so I was aware as we walked through this forest that Ebola virus was somewhere there with us. And it was kind of spooky, but it was also fascinating. And it began a process for me of wanting to learn more about Ebola, wanting to learn where the virus hides when it's not infecting and killing humans. And that led to this 5-year book project, yielding a book published in 2012 called Spillover, all about this whole group of diseases caused by viruses and bacteria that, and to some extent other microbes that come out of non-human animals and get into humans, that spill over from animal hosts and infect humans, and it's a group known as the zoonotic diseases. And so I did this book on that. Ebola was part of it, and then eventually I carved the Ebola sections out of that book and reshaped them with a new introduction, and that was my small book entitled Ebola, the Natural History of a Deadly Virus.
What have we learned about those types of diseases? And I'm a risk guy, so you know I gravitate towards these things almost quite naturally. But right. What do we know about the risk of these types of pandemics now?
Well, we know now a lot of things, although there are important things that we still don't know. Mm-hmm. We know that 60% of the infectious diseases that torment and kill humans fall in this category, zoonotic diseases. Mm-hmm. They come from non-human animals. We know that they spill over into humans because of opportunity, because we interact with those non-human animals who are carrying their own viruses. Mm-hmm. And occasionally those viruses latch onto us, enter us, and find that they can replicate abundantly and cause disease. It's a matter of opportunity when they do that. They don't seek us out. There's no purposefulness, but we're constantly interacting with animals, particularly wild animals are at issue. When we're killing and eating wild animals for bushmeat or for game, we expose ourselves to these viruses. When we're destroying diverse habitats to build timber camps or to establish mines, then we're shaking loose these viruses from their natural hosts. So it's a matter of we expose ourselves to risk from these viruses by the things that we do. Disturbing wild habitats, coming into contact with wildlife, and then our interconnectedness, the fact that you can get around the world by airplane in a matter of a dozen hours, means that once a new virus becomes a human infection, if it is highly transmissible from one human to another, then that thing can spread around the world, as I say, in a matter of 12, 14, 16 hours. It can go from a restaurant in Hong Kong to a hospital in Toronto that quickly.
Mm-hmm. Are some of these interactions more in the camp of uncertainties or risks? And I guess by that I mean, when we do something new, whether that's a mine or a new project in somewhere in the Congo Basin or Sub-Saharan Africa or something, do we have some sense of the probabilities of this type of thing happening, or is it more uncertain than that? Can these types of things break out unknowingly from different sources and different places?
Yes. There is a lot of uncertainty, absolutely, and that's an interesting distinction that I hadn't really thought much about. Implicitly, I dealt with it in the book, but explicitly, mm-hmm. the distinction between uncertainty and risk is a high degree of uncertainty. We never know what the next virus will be, where it will come from, and yet we can, to some extent, calibrate the risk based on what we're doing. If we're interacting with a lot of wild animals, there is risk. If we're interacting with certain wild animals, certain kinds of wild animals, there may be more risk. For instance, bats. Well, let me back up and introduce one term, and that is reservoir host. The reservoir host is the creature, the species, or group of species in which one of these pathogens, one of these viruses or dangerous bacteria live inconspicuously without causing symptoms generally and over long periods of time. And then spillover is when that pathogen, that virus, goes from its reservoir host into its first human victim. And so what is the reservoir host of one of these things? Well, part of the mystery story when a new virus emerges is to identify the reservoir host. And that's been done for a lot of these new viruses. For instance, the SARS virus, we know what the reservoir host is. It's a certain kind of bat native to southern China. But with Ebola, we still do not know the reservoir host. Bats have been suspects for a long time, but there is no ironclad gold standard proof that bats are the reservoir host of Ebola. Mm. And until we know that, there is a great deal of uncertainty as well as a great deal of risk in mucking around in forests in Central Africa, because you might expose yourself to the reservoir host, whatever it is, that's carrying Ebola.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's interesting and also obviously frightening. Is this also, and just to relate some of this to the tangled tree, is when we talk about horizontal gene transfer, is this an aspect of that? Are pandemics linked to that?
Not directly,
okay.
except when it comes to bacteria. But these emerging viruses, I'm not saying that it never happens and never implicates these emerging viruses, but it is mainly, it is more clear if you think about these things separately, except with pathogenic bacteria. For instance, the infamous MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which is a big problem now, and other forms of resistant bacteria. There are bugs that are killing thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world every year, forms of bacteria that we used to be able to deal with by hitting them with antibiotics. And now they have evolved resistance to those antibiotics, and so they become these superbugs that can't be cured, and they kill a lot of people. And it's spreading around the world, spreading around the world at high speed because of horizontal gene transfer, not just by incremental old-fashioned Darwinian evolution of resistance, but that plus this other phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer, which allows once one strain of bacteria has evolved in the incremental way resistance to a particular antibiotic, that resistant gene can be passed sideways to a completely different kind of bacterium in an instant by horizontal gene transfer.
Yeah, that's something that we don't hear, in my view, nearly enough about.
I agree.
You know, we talk about, you know, if you look at the headlines, the you know, concerns are always things like terrorism and crime and things like this, but antibiotic resistance is something that we ought to be really thinking about.
That's absolutely right. I think in the U.S. now, I think these antibiotic resistant bacteria, the whole group of them, I think they kill more than 11,000 people a year. So then, you know, an Ebola outbreak happens, and well, the great Ebola outbreak of 2014 killed about 11,000 people, mostly in West Africa, those three affected countries. And it got to the U.S. and it killed think the final count was one person in the U.S. and infected a few other people, and media and others in the U.S. went crazy with alarm, with fear over this. You know this well as a risk person, that the emotional response to different kinds of risk does not necessarily track the objective scale of that risk. That's probably an old truth in your field, but it's absolutely true in this context as well.
Yes, it is absolutely true. And the number of biases that I don't want to get into now, but we've covered off in that I've covered off in different episodes, but also in the work that I do. But one of them is recency bias, that we attribute a higher likelihood to a big catastrophic event that's recently happened as opposed to lots of other things. Okay, well, I wanted to transition into the Tangled Tree and the work that you did there, and how did this come about? Because you were trekking across Africa and doing all of this type of very field intensive type of work, and as you say, this is the your latest book is much more it doesn't involve that. I've heard you say that the jungle, if you will, is a different form of jungle. It's a different type of research.
And much of my work, as you say, both in the magazine form and the books that I've written, has involved this sort of field biology and outdoor adventure and following scientists through jungles, or climbing up onto rooftops in Bangladesh in the middle of the night to trap bats for the scientist who desperately hopes that these bats contain a lethal virus. So there has been risk and narrative possibilities and adventure in these other books. But then after I did the disease work in 2013, spring of 2013, I just happened in my various reading to come across mention of this phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer. And my first reaction was, wait, what? Genes moving sideways across species boundaries, across boundaries between kinds of creatures that are not even closely related, from one kingdom of life into another? And my first reaction was, well, that's impossible. I've written 3 or 4 books about evolution by that point, and I thought that I knew the reasons why it was impossible. But it turns out, as I read more deeply, I found out that it is possible, and there is good documentation, good evidence for it having occurred over the long stretches of time, genes moving sideways from one lineage into another, tangling the tree of life, so that the history of life on Earth hasn't been only just a matter of lineages diverging from one another and yielding biological diversity like the leaves on the canopy of the tree. But it has also involved convergence of lineages in the form of several processes that I describe in the book, including this process, horizontal gene transfer. And it startled me when I read about this in 2013. But as I dug into it further, I discovered, well, there's a whole world of work here, and it's fascinating. It's got some intriguing characters and some amazing revelations, and so it became a book project for me.
Could you give go for it. Sorry.
Despite the fact that it didn't allow me the advantage of walking through any jungles with scientists, except for these jungles of genomic data, as I said.
It's the whole concept sounds fascinating. I'm not a scientist, but the, as you describe, the kind of classic view of evolution is this branches off of a tree. Which actually you also describe that it was revolutionary at the time. When Darwin came home, he wasn't exactly didn't exactly publish this stuff right away. But could you perhaps give us some examples of horizontal gene transfer, that just to bring this to life a little bit? What are some of the examples
describe? We've already mentioned one category of this phenomenon, and that is the passage of genes from one kind of bacterium into another, sideways. These packets of genes, single genes or packets of genes that can move sideways from Staphylococcus into Streptococcus, Streptococcus into E. coli, spreading this resistance to antibiotics. But it also occurs in more complex forms of life. It can occur. It's known to have occurred in insects. It's known to have occurred in simple animals. It's known even to have occurred in vertebrate animals and even in humans. And so I'll bounce right to the most dramatic instance toward, that I described toward the end of my book, which is the fact, as now known from genomic data, the human genome, having been sequenced, we now know that roughly 8% of the human genome, yours and mine and everybody else's, is viral DNA that has been captured through sideways transmission over a long period of time, over the course of mammal evolution, 80 or 100 million years, but that 8% of our genome is viral DNA that has come in not by direct lineal descent from our remote animal ancestors, but by infection. They call it, sometimes they call it infective heredity. Infection by retroviruses that have been captured in our genome. Now, just before I get into specifics, I'll just say very briefly, you know, retrovirus, people have heard that term because HIV causing AIDS is a retrovirus. Retro suggesting backwards, and it's backwards because its genome is an RNA genome, a single strand of genetic information rather than a double strand like the double helix DNA molecule. DNA in most cases makes RNA, which is an information molecule, and then that is used to construct bodies, proteins, physical anatomy. Retroviruses go backwards because they can turn their RNA into DNA and then patch it into the genome of a cell of some creature that they infect. Now, when HIV does that, it patches itself into the genomes of immune cells. It infects immune cells and replicates by using the immune cells to make copies of itself. But if a retrovirus patches itself not into the immune cells of a human, but into the reproductive cells, eggs or sperm, ovaries or testes, then it can become heritable. It can be passed down to offspring, that retroviral DNA. And that is what has happened, yielding eventually this 8% of our genomes that have come in by infection.
And relatively, I'm going to kind of butcher this question because I'm not a biologist or a scientist, but if we think about the kind of classical, and what you're saying is not that, you know, the sort of tree of life format of evolution is you're saying that it still exists for the vast majority of you know, the mutations and adaptations and so forth, but if we were to think about infective hereditary changes to our genome, how much more quickly would that type of evolutionary change happen versus the more classical forms of evolutionary change? I don't know if this makes, you know, I phrase that in the right way,
that's not a butchered question. Okay. That's a good, totally coherent question.
Okay.
For which there is an answer. This form is much quicker. The old view of evolution, and Charles Darwin even quoted this old Latin adage, natura non facit saltum. Nature does not make leaps. So the classic Darwinian view and neo-Darwinian understanding from the 20th century is that variation in populations of creatures appears by incremental mutation, tiny mistakes as the genetic material copies itself. Darwin didn't know about genes, so he wouldn't have said, you know, genes, but tiny differences arise, and then natural selection works upon those variations in populations, and it serves as a sort of a strainer, and only the fittest survive to leave offspring. And lineages change because of that process. Incremental mutation creating variation, natural selection yielding linear change and adaptation. Mm. What's new, and that's all still true. These discoveries don't overturn that. They just add to that. Mm-hmm. And the main thing they add is a new quantum form of variation coming in by horizontal gene transfer. So it's not just these tiny, tiny steps. It's these lumps of change, these lumps of innovation that can come into a lineage and offer suddenly a major new possibility upon which natural selection then works.
Mm-hmm. It's the uberization of evolution. Does that make any sense?
I'll leave that to be your metaphor.
Right. Okay.
But people can imagine. Yeah. Your listeners can imagine the tree of life. The scientists would say the tree signal is still there.
Mm-hmm.
The tree-ishness of the history of life mm-hmm. is still there as a very good first take generalization. But what has been added is the understanding that it's not just a matter of diverging limbs and diverging branches ever diverging away from one another. It's also convergence. So the tangled tree of life of my title and as suggested by these discoveries is you should imagine a tree with big limbs and branches diverging mm-hmm. and then imagine also some limbs that move sideways or let's put it this way, some branches that come out of a limb on the left side of the tree and move sideways horizontally and flow into a limb on the other side of the tree carrying information.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't occur among real trees in the wild, but that's the modification, that's the entanglement that has been added by this whole field of discoveries I describe mm-hmm. in the book.
And how recent is all of this? You mentioned some names. Carl Woese is one of them. The other one that mm-hmm. I recognize from my conversation with Perry Marshall was Barbara McClintock. So
yes.
this is how recent is this scientific work?
There were intimations and hints of this going back to the 1950s. There mm-hmm. were some scientists, including Barbara McClintock, who was working in the 1950s, and there was the discovery. She discovered that genes can hop around within the genome of a given individual.
Mm-hmm.
They called them leaping genes. She didn't call them leaping genes, but others called them leaping genes. But that was within the genome of one, from chromosome to chromosome, or from one position to another in the chromosome. It wasn't yet understood that they could leap from one creature, one individual, one species into another. There was other work in the 50s that was detecting the phenomenon of horizontal gene transfer among bacteria, just among bacteria, where there are fewer constraints on it. So that was there. That was the groundwork. And that was all done without genome sequencing. But then Carl Woese came along in the 1970s, and he said, I'm going to use some cobbled together, dangerous, arduous methods and sequence at least fragments of genomes of different creatures so I can compare them and see which is more closely related to which other and how long ago they may have diverged, because he was interested in understanding the earliest history of life.
Mm.
And then others followed him, developing originally based on his method and then other methods of sophisticated genome sequencing. There was more and more genomic information available, the full genome, the whole stretch of the spelling of the genome in the DNA code, available for this organism or that species, and finally for the mouse, and then for the human species. And that new source of data yielded, plus high-powered computer diagnostics, computer comparisons of those masses of data, yielded this discovery that, holy cow, horizontal gene transfer has been going on in lots of different creatures, mm. and it may be extremely consequential in complex organisms, animals and plants, as well as in bacteria. Mm. And that was the legacy of Carl Woese and some of the other people I mentioned, Ford Doolittle, Lynn Margulis, and some of the other characters in my book.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a little bit about the implications of all of this more broadly, what does it mean in terms of, you know, who we are as species? And you even discuss, you know, what is a species?
Right. I say near the end of the book that all of these new discoveries and these constellations of new ideas and data have challenged three categorical ideas that had been part of our understanding of ourselves and the history of life on Earth. And those three categoricals are, first, the idea of species as something that is a discrete entity. Yes, it's a population of individuals, but it's a club with a fixed membership. A species as a discrete and unitary entity. Secondly, the idea of an individual also as a discrete unitary entity. There's an individual named Charles Robert Darwin. There's an individual dog that lives in your house. And thirdly, the tree as the image of the history of life on Earth, the tree of life as an evolutionary model. So there are these three ideas that have been treated as categorical absolutes, the species, the individual, and the tree. And we now understand from these discoveries that all three of those categoricals are wrong. They're not entirely wrong, but they're wrong if they're taken as absolutes, as categoricals. The truth is much more tangled and complicated.
What do you make of so taking this step further with CRISPR and gene editing and all of that stuff? How does this relate back to, you know, back to that? Maybe does this mean right. that we can make some, we can actually engineer some dramatic shifts into evolution somehow?
Well, we know from the CRISPR technology, which I discuss near the end of the book, this new method of gene editing, which is more accurate, more reliable, quicker and cheaper than any other form of gene editing, genetic modification that we've seen before. We know that amazing things can be done, both good things and scary things, morally complicated things can be done with CRISPR and will be done soon, no doubt, including the correction of congenital diseases in the fetus, including a human fetus, an early human fetus. That's, nobody can argue with that. That sounds wonderfully beneficial. But also the possibility of designer babies, not just correction of mutations that would cause misery and disease in the life of a child, but improvements that wealthy, affluent parents might seek. You know, I don't want my child just to be healthy and free of congenital disease. I want her to be smarter than the other babies that are born and with more musical or athletic ability or things like that. Now, that's on the horizon, but it's not that distant a horizon. Those are going to involve a lot of important moral and ethical conversations in our communities as to whether everything that can be done should be done. But one implication of this whole story of horizontal gene transfer upon that conversation is that if we're aware of these things that I describe in the book, you may say, well, I have problems with the ethics of genetic modification and the possible ecological implications of turning loose genetically modified organisms. But you can't say that it's unnatural, because in fact nature has been doing it, moving genes from one kind of creature into another for 3.5 billion years.
What's the mechanism for a horizontal gene transfer to, you know, to take place and to stick?
Well, there's several different kinds of mechanism, and there are some mysteries in some of the categories of this transfer that has been detected as to what the mechanism is. But the simple answer to your question, Ben, is infective heredity, infection. And that's the sort of the broader category. And that means that both bacteria and viruses, when they infect another kind of creature, can potentially bring in DNA that gets patched into the genomes. viruses can perform. So I mentioned retroviruses inserting themselves, their DNA, into mammalian genomes, including the human genome. So that's one category of this brought about by viral infection. But viruses can also do a sort of drag and drop thing, where they might infect one kind of a creature, and in infecting the interior of the cell, they might pick up a bit of DNA from that creature's genome and incorporate it in their own genome. Then that virus particle replicates itself, and that new bit of DNA is replicated, and then the virus bursts out of that creature and goes on to infect another individual creature, and maybe an individual of a different species, getting itself into the cells. If it gets into the reproductive cells, then it can potentially drop that bit of DNA that it pulled out of another creature and leave it behind in the genome of a new creature.
Jeez.
And that's a process that the scientists call transduction, mm-hmm. Carrying across, leading across, transduction.
And are we close to understanding why some organism might be a better host than others for some of these genes, or is that
well? There is, yeah. Yes. There's mm-hmm. some knowledge on that. There's one scientist in his group who have shown that it does help if the recipient organism is relatively closely related to the donor organism. The DNA is more likely to fit into the very complex interactive system that a genome is. I mean, it's possible that the DNA might be brought and then just dropped in a new genome by horizontal gene transfer and then just be there, non-active, non-functional, what people used to call junk DNA, all this excess information that doesn't seem to have any function in a genome. But scientists now are more careful about that, and they don't tend to call that junk DNA anymore. They simply say, well, this is DNA that, if it has a function, we haven't discovered its function yet. But for a gene or a stretch of DNA to fit in and have a function and remain in a genome, it's more likely to fit in if, say, if it goes from one form of reptile into another. It might be better able to fit into the system. And yet it's not necessarily so that there has to be a close relationship. Again, going back to humans and retroviruses, we have now in the human genome, there's a gene that came by way of a retrovirus. And in the retrovirus, it formed an envelope, a form of membrane around the virus capsule. Mm-hmm. It got into different versions of this gene got into animal lineages, and as mammals were evolving, this envelope-forming viral gene was repurposed to forming a different kind of membrane. It's mm-hmm. the membrane between the placenta and the fetus, including a version of this in humans, that this viral gene now creates this membrane between the placenta and the fetus, which is absolutely crucial to successful human pregnancy. The membrane helps to transport nutrients from the placenta into the fetus, helps to transport waste products from the fetus back out to the placenta so that the female can get rid of those waste products, and possibly also protects the fetus from the immune system of the mother, because, of course, the fetus only has 50% of her genes, and the other 50% are the father's genes. So her immune system might attack that. So this is a gene that comes from a completely different form of life, retrovirus, and yet it is now functioning beneficently, even crucially, in human physiology and reproduction.
Yeah, holy cow! Like when I learned that, that just blew me away. And I think you were asked once. Would that mean that we would be laying eggs if this didn't happen?
Right. It might be. We know that this goes back to different forms of mammals. They have different forms of placental mammals. Mm-hmm. They have different versions of this gene. We don't know yet whether it was in the earliest placenta developmental mammals. That's a matter for research right now. But there is the possibility suggested by the people who've worked on this, including a wonderful Frenchman named Thierry Heidemann on the south side of Paris that I visited. Mm-hmm. There is speculation that possibly this was a key element that allowed mammals to develop the capacity to carry their offspring, they're nurturing the offspring that they're nurturing, their fetal offspring, inside their bodies rather than having to encase the offspring in an eggshell and lay it, get it out of their bodies. This allows the possibility of internal pregnancy, which opened perhaps the pathway to the evolution of placental mammals.
And one of the big surprises that you mention in your book that we as humans evolved from creatures that a few decades ago we didn't even know existed. Is that
right?
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this is a group of creatures called the archaea. Mm. Arc is an old, you know, archaic archaeology. The archaea, and it is a separate domain. It is the third great limb on the tree of life. They were unknown to exist before 1977. We've mentioned passingly this character, Carl Woese, mm-hmm. this microbiologist at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois, in the 1970s. He was the one with his colleagues, his students and postdocs, who discovered this form of life. They were unknown to exist. They were thought to be just other kinds of bacteria. They looked like bacteria through a microscope. They're small. They're single celled. They have no complex internal structure, no cell nuclei, no internal organelles. So through a microscope or an electron microscope, these things look like bacteria, and they had been taken for bacteria. And then for 150 years, and then Carl Woese started sequencing their genomes, and he said, "Holy cow! These things aren't even bacteria. They're completely different from bacteria, judged by their genomes. And furthermore, they're more similar to us, to complex creatures, to animals, plants, and fungi." The group known as the eukaryotes, the kingdom Eukarya, they're more similar to that group, our group, than they are to bacteria. So suddenly there was a third major limb on the tree of life instead of just two. And I forget your question, and I was trying to circle back to it. But
well, it was linking back to, you know, who we are as a species.
Okay. Let me add that bit. Mm. So these things, a new form of life. Mm-hmm. We know that complex life arose by, and this is another interesting story I tell in the book, by the capture of entire bacteria that were internalized and became internal organs. Mm. We have organs in our cells called mitochondria that are crucial for packaging energy. Mm-hmm. There was a scientist named Lynn Margulis who revived a theory in the 1960s that these mitochondria are the descendants of captured bacteria that have become internalized in host cells that have become our complex cells. Mm. And that theory was confirmed by genome sequencing in the tradition of Carl Woese. So we know that Lynn Margulis was right about that. She was working from visual information microscopy, but genome sequencing confirmed that theory. So then another question is, well, if these complex cells arose by capturing bacteria and turning them into internal organs, what were the host creatures that captured those bacteria? And those had always thought to be other bacteria, but now new work just in the last 2 or 3 years suggests that the host cells from which we are descended were archaea and not bacteria. So that our deepest ancestors, 3.5 billion, maybe 3.8 billion years ago, the lineage that led to us is this group, archaea, that was completely unknown to exist before 1977.
Wow. That's amazing. That just blows me away.
Well, that's how I felt when I was researching this book. I was saying, "Oh my God, what? Holy cow."
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of the other surprises that that you uncovered? Things that blew you away in researching and writing this book.
Well, I mentioned this idea of captured bacteria. Mm-hmm. That was one of them, and I had heard about this idea. It has the fancy name endosymbiosis, meaning you've got a partner that lives on the inside, a partner who lives inside you. Mm-hmm. And I knew of Lynn Margulis. I even met Lynn Margulis. Spent a long day with her on a field trip through Yellowstone Park, having wonderful conversation with her. Before I ever knew that I would write a book that would include a long section on her work. We were talking about disease at that point, mostly because I was doing my disease book. So when I got interested in this subject, horizontal gene transfer in the tree of life, it led me back to her work, endosymbiosis. And then I discovered that her work had been confirmed through the methodology that Carl Woese had pioneered of this very primitive and dangerous form of genome sequencing of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And there was another scientist, Ford Doolittle, who adopted Woese's methodology, which involved toxic chemicals and explosive solvents and high voltage and radioactive phosphorus to break genomes into pieces and then to pull them apart and read the letters of these different fragments of DNA and assemble paragraphs and compare them. That was what Woese was doing. Ford Doolittle adopted that. And one of the first things he did was, well, let's use this to test Lynn Margulis's theory of endosymbiosis. Let's look at these bacteria inside these organs inside human cells that have their own DNA. We call it mitochondrial DNA. Let's look at that. Let's sequence it and let's see what it tells us. And he did that, and he said, lo and behold, Lynn was right. This stuff resembles bacteria, one particular kind of bacteria, a group known as the alpha proteobacteria. This is a close match to them, so yes, she must be right. Our cells evolved by capturing alpha proteobacteria billions of years ago and turning it into internal organs.
Jeez, wow. What in terms of the things that you've picked up, along the way, I'm curious in terms of what maybe frighten isn't the right word for it, but we talked a little bit about the implications of all of this. We talked previously about pandemics, but are there things that you wonder about that if you extend this in terms of our understanding of the world, are there some risks and uncertainties out there that
absolutely yeah.
What are some of those?
Well, I mentioned the ethical and moral questions that we face now that we know two things. We know that that movement of genes from one kind of creature into another is a natural phenomenon that has been going on in the past and probably has had big implications, big consequences in evolutionary history. And now also we have CRISPR and other methods that are arising that make it ever easier and more efficacious mm-hmm. to move genes around in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. We move ideas around in the library and genes around in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. So what occurs to me and has occurred to other people is that two of those three categories, well, all three of those categoricals I mentioned, the species is a categorical, is an absolute, the individual is an absolute, the tree is the image of life on Earth. Those things are challenged, and those things are going to be, we now recognize they are somewhat blurry, they're going to become more blurry. So the very concept of a species, I mean, we're fighting to preserve biological diversity on this planet. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to do it species by species, habitat by habitat, ecosystem by ecosystem. But now we're also capable of blurring lines between species. Mm. I'm concerned with where that's going to go 100 years from now. Are we even going to be able to talk about the species? The blue whale is a species. The lowland gorilla is a species. Are we going to be able to do that? The tiger is a species. Are we going to have that that concept? Are we going to have the biological diversity that we have now, or is it all going to get mixed? Likewise with individuals. You know, we've had heart transplants for, you know, 50 or 60 years. We have other forms of organ transplant. Mm-hmm. Now we've got gene editing. What's it going to mean in 100 years to say that this is a human individual? That's what really dizzies me, and it scares me to a certain extent, because there are moral and ethical risks that come with these extraordinary scientific insights and technological powers that we are gaining.
I mean, don't worry, David. By that time, the machines will take over, right? So the AI will.
There you go.
We'll do that work.
right. There we go into another field. Yeah, that you know exactly. More about than I do. But yes, absolutely. That's part of it.
I've said this before, but it's going to get weird. Things are going to get really weird.
Yes, I'm sure you're right, and it's going to be blurring not just of the lines between species and the lines around individuals, but the lines between life and non-life, lines between living creature and machine, as you've just suggested. That's going to be blurring too, right, Ben? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah. And we don't know what that's going to. I mean, there's more uncertainties than certainties, certainly. That sounded either profoundly philosophical or just pretty banal, but it's super, super fascinating. I did want to touch on some of the individuals that you chronicle and that you've met. Before that, I don't know if you if this relates to anything specific in your book, but I did have some questions over the DNA of the octopus, if you know anything about that and how that relates to any of the work that you've done.
I don't. I did a conversation on stage with a wonderful science writer colleague of mine named Cy Montgomery, mm-hmm. and she has recently written a book on the octopus, I think, mm-hmm. the science natural history of the octopus. I haven't yet read it, but I will. But tell me. No, I don't know.
I don't know very much about it either. Other than it's very different from anything else on Earth.
You should get Cy Montgomery to talk with you.
I'll definitely try. So that's a very good suggestion. As I said, I did want to talk a little bit about some of the individuals that you've that we've mentioned, mm-hmm. and some of them, Carl Woese, you describe, he turned into a bit of a recluse later in life. Barbara McClintock, her work was recognized much later in her life. And conversely, Charles Darwin was quite a, he almost didn't want to be the father of the theory of evolution. He was more straight-laced, and I'm curious. You've spoken to a lot of scientists. Do those who come up with very interesting ideas, are they a little bit different from other scientists?
Oh, they are.
Yeah,
they are. And you suggested an interesting irony or phenomenon, and that is that some of the scientists who make radical, revolutionizing discoveries just live for that kind of thing. Uh-huh. They love to throw a spanner in the works.
Right.
They love controversy. They love to be radical and shocking.
Yes.
And Lynn Margulis was wonderful that way. She had lots of really edgy ideas and embraced some risky theories and was proven right about some, and history seems to have proved her wrong about others. But she loved the ferment of that. And Carl Woese was that way to some degree. As you mentioned, he was very solitary. He was kind of crotchety. He could be a wonderful, charming, supportive human being, and he could be a real bear. And that's one of the things that I loved about him and made me put him as my sort of my central character in the book, that he was complex. Darwin, on the other hand, I've written a short biography of Darwin that's titled "The Reluctant Mr. Darwin," mm-hmm. and as you suggest, he was reluctant to make waves. I've said, I think it's in that book, that one of the ways of understanding Darwin is that he was an essentially conservative person who found himself burdened with an extremely radical idea, and he was constitutionally so honest, so curious, and so straightforward that even though it caused him a lot of discomfort and caused discomfort to his loved ones and a lot of his friends, he had to carry through eventually and publish that radical idea. So he sort of falls at one end of the spectrum. Lynn Margulis, maybe Carl Woese at the other end. Barbara McClintock was a very courageous scientist who really believed in her own data and her own understanding of the organism. She famously said, "You have to have a feel for the organism." In her case, that was corn, maize, and she that was her experimental model. And she studied the genomes of maize for 40, 50 years and got a Nobel Prize late in life. Mm-hmm. But she did her work very quietly, very soberly. She didn't publicize herself. She just wanted to understand the implications of what she was seeing in the different colored kernels on an ear of corn. And so she was of the quiet revolutionary type.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I think in all of our organizations and societies, we need, we need those people that think a little bit differently, disruptors, right. Outliers, those right. Types of people. And I guess, conversely, there are loads of people that go into science and, end up, I don't know, designing food additives or, something kind of boring.
That's right. Yeah. And there are only a few people. Woese is part of a rare group that are just so deeply curious about the big questions. What is the shape of the early history of life? Where have we come from? That he criticized molecular biology late in his life in one of his crotchety sort of overview, more philosophical articles. He criticized molecular biology for having turned into what he called an engineering discipline. And what he meant by that was that it was concerned with practical questions like, minor things like human health. Mm-hmm. and he was much more interested in, what happened 3.5 billion years ago? Now, both those things are obviously important and necessary, but Woese, crotchety as he was, said, molecular biology, it shouldn't be just an engineering discipline. It should answer the big, deep, ancient questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we need people like that in this world.
Yes.
And
yes.
There aren't, I suppose in some sense we there will always be people like that, but going back to the when we started, we also need more polymaths and people that can kind of join those dots between different disciplines. Otherwise everything becomes hyper specialized and monoculture.
That's right.
We covered a lot. Was there anything else around the Tangled Tree that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to mention?
Well, we mentioned this, but I guess the only thing I would add is that going back to sort of where we started, science is a human process, mm-hmm. a human activity. And so this is a book of amazing discoveries, a radical new history of life, as my subtitle says. It's not my radical new history. It's the radical new history that was patched together by Carl Woese and Ford Doolittle and Lynn Margulis and mm-hmm. others. So it's filled with deep questions and boggling discoveries, but it's also filled with, I hope, with humanity, with the stories mm-hmm. of these individual people. It's a narrative a line that I follow from Darwin through Margulis and Woes to work that's being done now by Thierry Heidemann and others. It's one long story that has some amazing characters and that I hope will cause people to want to turn the page to find out what's going to happen there.
It's fascinating. I mean, if this conversation is anything to go by, I'm sure my listeners will be very interested in the book. I did want to, before we kind of get off that the topic and wrap up, I did want to, you mentioned that you felt that doing this book was a bit of a risk on your part. Is that because you wanted to do it justice? It was a slightly different way of writing a book. What was it that
I've called it my riskiest and most ambitious book because it goes deep into the weeds. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I've cut a clear path with a machete through those weeds for ordinary readers. You don't have to be a science nerd to read this book, or I hope to like this book, to enjoy this book. But it was risky because the science is so complex and so counterintuitive that it would seem to be hard to get your head around it, and it would seem perhaps to be daunting for ordinary readers. So that's why I consider it risky and ambitious, but I've been gratified so far at the responses to it. People saying, "Hey, this son of a gun, this is a good read." For the love of God, I hope so. So that's what I mean by that risky. On one level, it's a history of molecular phylogenetics in the 20th mm-hmm. century.
Right. That doesn't roll off the tongue.
And that, yeah. Right. That doesn't sound like an elevator pitch. Yeah. That doesn't sound like a model for commercial success, but it's been on the bestseller list and it's been well received by people so far. So I'm feeling, and my publisher is feeling at this point with a very provisional sigh of relief and encouragement that it's been a risk worth taking.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Speaking of which, what are your next projects? What do you have on the horizon? What would you like to do?
Well, I work a lot for National Geographic magazine, and I have a 5-story project going with them. They want me to write a series of 5 stories under the rubric The Last Wild Places of Planet Earth. Not all the last wild places, obviously, but certain select wild places that are being conserved, or people are attempting to conserve them with new models of conservation unique to the 21st century that might yield successes in ways that are all of our efforts to conserve biological diversity and wild habitats in the 20th century have not been adequately successful. So I owe a lot of my time to National Geographic for this series of 5 stories, which will eventually become a book also. And in the meantime, I've got some ideas for my next book for my publisher, Simon & Schuster, who published The Tangled Tree. Mm-hmm. But it's a little too early to talk about that.
Sure. Excellent. Well, before we wrap up, was there anything else that we...
I'm delighted with what we've covered. Yeah,
we've ranged a lot of ground,
a lot, but we've gotten in a little bit deeply as well as broadly.
Oh, that's fabulous stuff, David. This was very interesting. In terms of the book and yourself, for my listeners who want to know more and want to pick up a copy of the book, where can they do that?
Well, your local bookstore, your local independent, is always good. A chain, Amazon, it's available.
It's on audio as well.
It's on audiobooks. Yeah. It's available in Britain as well as the US mm-hmm. now. I'm not sure about Australia just yet. And it's available, and the publisher is Simon & Schuster. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the online dealers, or your local independent bookstore.
Perfect. And if people want to follow you,
I'm easy to find. Yep. My website is simply davidquammen.com, mm-hmm. and I'm on Twitter at davidquammen.
Excellent. Are you active on Twitter?
I'm semi-active. I like to follow Twitter, and I've got some conversations that I like to be part of there.
Excellent. Great. Well, David, this was fascinating. This was fabulous. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad for the chance to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed it too.
thank you very much. And okay. let's stay connected, and be great to connect further, and maybe have you back on for your next project, or to bring you on. And I've been thinking about kind of a panel discussion, but I'm not quite sure how to do that yet, or if and when and how and so forth. But
sounds good to me. I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Ben.
All right. Bye for now.
Ciao.
I hope you all found that as fascinating as I did. David's latest book, once again, is The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life on Earth. Check it out. Links are in the show notes. You can even pick up an audio version with a free trial of Audible. So links for that are also in the show notes. And a reminder, if you've recently made a big decision, I want to hear from you. I've created a short survey. Links are also in the show notes. Or you can just drop me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com, and tell me what you think about the show, some recommendations you might have for guests, or anything related to risk and uncertainty. Would love to hear from you. And I say this every episode, but if you have not yet subscribed, please do so. Allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, is the best place to find all the ways in which you can do that. We will be back in 3 weeks at the latest. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.